This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by Bed Intentions, a modern wellness brand that celebrates the evolving spectrum of pleasure. We spend a third of our lives in bed, so why not make it fun, safe, and easy? Head to bedintentions.com to shop their natural self-care products.
And when they played the footage back of the birth, it looked like some soft porn movie. And back then there wasn't a green chemistry movement. I do remember doing 16-hour days. I wasn't very present with her on the computer and typing up invoices, and I'd have her attached to my breast, and I just wasn't there when I was feeding her. I just kept going. I got really used to running like that, which was not really very healthy. She terrified me from the age of 14 to 17. And I gave her an ultimatum.
I'm fascinated by founders and business owners like Mukti because she's been incredibly successful with her skincare brand Mukti Organics, but she totally flies in the face of the highly corporate, suit-clad, city-dwelling business person that we often associate with success. Instead, she does things a little differently. She gave birth in a teepee, for one. Her mum was, in her words, a crazy hippie woman who renounced everything and went off to India. She was a young mum, and she founded her business before the certified organic movement was even a thing. In fact, before social media was even a thing. She's funny, she's honest, she has some incredible tales to tell. And as someone in the earlier days of navigating parenthood and paid work, I value the wisdom of those mums that have come before me to no end. From storing products underneath tarps hanging off the back of her house and navigating separation, to reflecting on 16-hour workdays and what she now regrets. Here, she covers it all with generosity and humility. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is the deep and down-to-earth Mukti. Mukti, I believe you went through a bit of a transformation when your daughter was born, and I'd love to hear all about becoming Mukti, what it means, and also moving out of the city at that time too.
Yes, it was a big change. I didn't want to, well, first of all, the name Mukti is a Sanskrit name, and I always felt like my Christian name did not suit me. So I knew that there was a Sanskrit name and I knew it ended in KTI, but I didn't have the full phonetics of it. It's really, really strange because when I was in my late teens, I used to get these words that would come to me. I didn't know what they were, didn't know what they meant. I just wrote them down. And that was back in the day when there was no Google. So you actually had to go to a library and look them up. And I'd had this list of words that I had collected, and they were all Sanskrit words, unbeknownst to me. So then when I was in a yoga lesson, my teacher said the word Mukti. And I knew then in that moment that was what I wanted to be called, or that was my name. It all sounds really weird. But that's actually what happened. So I walked out of that class and I was living in a community. It was a permaculture community, which we'd moved to just before I had Kiana. Because I didn't want to raise my kids in the city. I really wanted to have more of a rural experience for them because I'm a country girl myself. And I wanted them to have fresh air and lots of sunshine and animals and nature around them. So that was why I moved there. And while I was living in this community, it was quite common for people to change their names. So, you know, there was moon and sun and sky and river and everyone. That's a different name to their birth name, so it was quite well accepted to change my name. So I did, and I embraced the word Mukti, but unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize that most people wouldn't know how to pronounce it. So two big learnings is, one, don't call a brand after yourself, and two, don't call a brand after yourself if people can't pronounce the name. I've had Mukti, Matuki, Mukti, Mukti. The one I really love is Mukti. What I love is when people ring up and they chat to customer care and they say, oh, yes, I've been using Mukti for years. She's a friend of mine. And it's like, tick off the friends and family list straight away. So, yes, it is pronounced Mukti phonetically.
Yeah.
And it means freedom and liberation, which is also a misnomer because if you're starting a business, the last thing you are going to be is free and liberated. So, yeah.
Well, you did pretty well with a brand that some people weren't pronouncing it right. So we will get to that. But what was career life or working life like for you pre-motherhood? What were you up to then?
So I am a fairly avid studier. I studied complementary medicine. I studied acupuncture and I studied naturopathy, but I kept circling back to herbs. I kept loving herbal medicine and botany and plants and aromatherapy. So that was my big passion. And then I also studied as a skin therapist. So my husband and I had a couple of hairdressing salons in Brisbane. And then I saw an opportunity to work as a remedial therapist, but also as a skin therapist out of those two businesses. So they complemented each other. So that was what I was doing at the time.
And when it came to the idea of motherhood, was that something you had thought much through the lens of how you would make a career life work with motherhood? Was it something you jostled with much?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I did not plan to fall pregnant. It just happened, and it happened when I was still quite young. So it was I wouldn't say it was a shock. I was really excited about that. And I've always had this work ethic where I'm not very good at relaxing. I'm not very good at stopping. I'm not very good at just doing one thing, or just I didn't know what I was going to be in for with having a child. I don't think you do when you have nothing prepares you for it. When you have your first child, it is such a change, a fundamental change. And you somehow have this idea, I think, in your head that it's going to be easy. The child's going to sleep. I'll get stuff done. It'll be fine. You know, I'm going to have a baby that sleeps. But you just don't know what you're going to get, and nothing prepares you for it. I think every mother would absolutely agree with that. So I didn't know what I was in for. But when we moved to the community, I also set up a shop there. So it was like a co-op where people could bring their produce and sell it. So I was doing that on the day that I started going into labor. I was actually working, and I didn't even really know that I was in labor until at the end of the day, and I knew something wasn't quite right. So that was pretty much it. From the beginning, I just worked and had a baby at the same time. And I remember after giving birth, I had a very non-traditional birth as well. I had a teepee set up and we had a hot water tub, and there was some footage of this birth. ABC got hold of it for some reason. They were doing a segment on alternative people from the country, from Mulaney, and they ended up interviewing me. And when they played the footage back of the birth, it looked like some soft porn movie. I was at the Fire Event Festival at Woodford Folk Festival. It was just the way they'd spliced it all together. Like, oh my God. But yeah, so nothing was traditional about the birth or going into that. I remember going home, and the next day someone came around to visit and I was sweeping the floor or I was mopping or doing something, and I remember this person's face and they were aghast and they were bringing some food around and they just looked at me with absolute horror. Like, what are you doing? Just thank goodness I had lots of energy. Yeah. I think that was the thing too, is just being early 20s, you've got a lot more energy. I think that was definitely helpful. Yeah.
And what did early motherhood look like for you after that point? What do you remember most?
I remember I actually was also very determined not to use disposable nappies. So I was using cloth nappies. I remember washing all these tie-dyed cloth nappies and spending hours doing that until one day I realized, I think I went for a trip into Brisbane and I took some disposable nappies with me, and then that was it. I was ruined. I was like, I am not washing nappies. I'm not doing it. But I don't think back then that they were that environmentally friendly. So I was pretty determined to not make too much of an impact. So yeah, it was hard then, the challenge of not using the good old tie-dyed cloth nappies.
Yeah.
I was running that shop as well. And then Mukti Organics wasn't launched. Kiana was born in 95, and then Mukti Organics wasn't officially launched until 2000. So in that time, I was still doing some studying. I was actually doing a psych degree as well. And I did my first, fortunately, I didn't complete, but I did 3 years of it. And then it got to data analysis and statistics, and I just couldn't go there.
It's so funny that you say that, because that is what stopped me from picking psychology over media at university. So there you go.
Yeah. There you go. Data analysis and statistics, I just couldn't see how I could use them in my life, and it had no bearing on what I wanted to do, which was to actually be a clinical psychologist. And I was just like, no, I don't want to do this. She'd say, hey. So I think, I wonder if a lot of people get to that point where they're just like, no, what's the application in this? I'm not going to use it.
And that's not how my brain works. And the things that I think would have made me a good psychologist have nothing to do with stats. So it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then you're a mother of about a five-year-old, and you become Mukti the person, but then Mukti Organics, the business, starts to take shape. I'm trying to even picture now launching a business in that era where social media really didn't exist at all, did it? So tell us about bringing this brand to life.
Well, social media didn't exist, but also there was no, you know, when you were wanting to research something, there were, you'd have to go to a library, you'd have to use books. And so there was really nowhere to turn to. And I remember there was a course that was available, and it was how to make natural skincare products. And I did that. Someone came up from the Sunshine Coast from Melbourne, and I absolutely loved it. And that was pretty much what got me started. And then I was also working as a part-time therapist at a guest lodge in Mullaney, a bed and breakfast. And lots of teachers and nurses would come there for Mondays and Tuesdays. They had a special offer. So they'd come in big groups of 8 or 9 women, and we'd massage them and then give them a facial. And so I was using bits and pieces of different brands, and I thought, you know, wow, this is, and I'd already done that course. And then I just started thinking, it can't be too hard. Surely I could just make my own products, and then I could look at that as being another form of creating an income stream, as opposed to just being reliant on a service. So that was pretty much how it all started. So I made a few products which were very embarrassingly rudimentary. So I started with a cleanser and a mist and a moisturizer. They're far, far removed from what I have formulated today, because I was still really figuring it all. And back then there wasn't a green chemistry movement. There wasn't a certified organic movement. There wasn't organic certification for skincare. I did know that I wanted to create a really clean, effective product range. It was also something that I could use professionally, but I was a long way off from that. And then it morphed into I found a cosmetic chemistry formulating a course. It was a diploma, and that was out of the UK. And then I did that as well. So then that helped me to understand when things went terribly wrong, and I'd spent all my money on these ingredients and their formulation failed, and there was no one to turn to say, hey, I don't know what's going on. You know, pH related, is it temperature related? I'm not sure what's happening at this point, and how do I bring this back and say, you know, this formula. So it was very much figuring it all out just through trial and error and experimentation. Yeah.
And do you say that the organic movement and the green skincare movement wasn't quite there? How do you inform people of such products when they're not quite even there with the education yet? How did you market it and educate people?
Great question. No one really wanted to know about it, and no one really thought that it was a thing. It wasn't a thing back then. I recognized it as a niche, and I recognized that it was going to be a thing. So that's probably what gave me the impetus to keep going and the tenacity just to keep going and keep reinvesting. And then around that time, I ended up leaving my husband. It was around sort of, actually it was a bit earlier. I think Kiana was around 2, and I had enough money to buy a computer, which was obviously not a laptop. And it was,
I can imagine,
DOS.
It was quite chunky.
It was still DOS, so it was just like, oh, so hard to use. But, and it was just the time of the .com. So I had the foresight to also get register the name as well.
Yeah.
And it was just, yeah, everything was very, very different landscape. So obviously it's much easier today to start up any sort of business, which is fantastic because it means everyone can be in control of their own destiny and be an entrepreneur. But back then it was unheard of almost. And the other thing I think that really helped me to get started was I went to the markets, the Umundi markets. So back then I'd be making the products and bottling them and then packaging them. And then I would go to the markets a couple of times a week. And that was where I made what I called my sushi money. And then I also at that same time was studying the new employment incentive scheme. And that was my rent money. And so that was my two sort of revenue streams in amongst doing facials for clients as well, and then sort of studying and trying to find out how I could make these products better. So I was pretty busy.
Wow.
You know, when you ask me how I did it, I actually don't know. I do know I was doing very, very long days. I do remember doing 16-hour days, and I do remember Aisha, probably my second child who I had in 2001. So I wasn't very present with her. And as far as, you know, I'd be on the computer and typing up invoices and I'd have her attached to my breast and I just wasn't there when I was feeding her. And I mean, I'm not saying that in every moment that you're feeding your child, you need to be present because it's not going to happen. But I do have regrets about that where you're literally, you know, banging away on the keyboard. It's like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. And I don't know, you just do it. You just do it. And for me, I didn't have a backup plan. My dad had died and my mum was not financial. My mum was a crazy hippie woman who went off to India and left everything and renounced everything.
Wow.
So I was pretty much like, well, I just have to make this work because there's not a plan B and there's not a couch I can go and crash on if it doesn't work. And there's nowhere else I can take these two children. So I just kept going. And I mean, there was one time when we had tarps hanging off the back of the house where we were storing things. And this is before I could afford to move the business into the first premises. And yeah, I think it was just a lot of long days and hard work and wearing many different hats and juggling a lot. And yeah, I appreciate that all the aspects of the business because you had to do everything back then. It wasn't really like you could not employ someone at that stage. I couldn't afford to bring someone else in. The first person I brought in was a bookkeeper and someone to sort of help with the administration side of it. And then I did everything else.
Yeah. What year was that? Do you remember?
Between 2000 and 2006, I was running the business underneath my house. So I had out of 40 square meters, we had offices in 20 square meters. And then we had in the other 20 square meters, we had that as the production room and we were making all the products out of there. And I remember back then even getting orders, you know, $60,000 orders from Malaysia and from overseas, and we'd have to try and produce these products. And it was out of this 40 square meter space. So I don't even know how we did that.
Yeah.
That's interesting looking.
Incredible. Wow. Yeah. So you navigated a breakup. Navigated the loss of your father, and all the while you're looking after or mothering two children and building this business. I imagine there's sort of an era where you really sort of step into the second act of that business. Maybe it's when you get an office, maybe you can tell me otherwise. What was it like when it got to that stage where you really felt, I guess, cemented in it and like you could maybe take a little bit of a breath of fresh air?
That's it. Also a really good question. It didn't happen for me, actually. It didn't happen for a long time. I had a lot of hurdles and I bootstrapped the whole way. I still am. I haven't got any investment in the business at all. So it's really just been me reinvesting that capital back into the business, which has been, you know, a lot slower organic growth and lots of learnings along the way. I didn't really relax because I've always wanted to continue to improve, and having a warehouse definitely helped. Moving the business out of home really helped, and having more space, and then slowly employing more people to do those jobs. But also just having only had the new employment incentive scheme and no real corporate background or commercial background made it very challenging as well. And at one stage, I nearly merged with another very well-known makeup brand, which is still, well, makeup and skincare now, which is still around today. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it got to the 11th hour and there was a sunset clause and I pulled out of that merger, but I nearly lost the whole business then. There was another incident where I nearly lost the whole business when I had just got the products to a certified organic status and I was using a preservative system, and the preservative system had been tested by the man who had sold me the preservative system, and I didn't do any independent testing. And unbeknownst to me, I was just launching as a certified organic range. And I was at a trade show in Hong Kong and I was having meetings with potential distributors. And I had a phone call from one of the girls back at the office and they said, "Mukti, we've just noticed mold spores in some of the products that you've got on hand that you've taken with you." And I wouldn't believe it because we were just about to launch with this whole new range. And literally I had to come back from that trade show and put everything, every bit of product, everything that I'd spent on that launch into a skip bin, into several big skip bins. And it was literally ground zero. It was starting again. And what I realized is that person that I'd bought that preservative system from had done all his own testing, but he'd done it within his own laboratory that he'd used. So it failed. The preservative system failed. And I was back to like zero, ground zero. That was another really, a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear, I guess, was, and a lot of cortisol and adrenaline was just running all the time. So I got really used to running like that, which was not really very healthy. And so, yeah, I think I definitely had a few burnout periods and there was definitely times where I was like, "This is too hard. I give up. Like, you know, please don't send me any more challenges." And also times when there's nothing in the bank, there's nothing to pay staff wages, there's nothing to pay your bills. And that's a really frightening predicament to be in as well. But somehow, I don't know, miraculously, each time something would happen or somehow I'd manage to rebuild. And so I have rebuilt several times. And then the last big change was when we moved the business here in 21 from the Sunshine Coast back down to the Mullumbimby Byron Bay region. Yeah.
Incredible. Wow. How do you navigate burnout when there's so much riding on you and there's so much at stake? Because there's motherhood and there's feeling responsible for people and then there's business and, as you say, feeling responsible for staff. How did you navigate that?
I do feel like, for me, my personal routine has definitely helped, and having a really solid meditation practice has definitely helped. At times it was probably, "Oh gosh, that's another thing I have to do." But now for me, it's so ingrained where it's like I want to. And if I don't do that, then it's the priority for me is that taking that 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon, that's really a savior for me. And it's now non-negotiable. And I really wish I'd had that practice the whole way through. It would have definitely helped a lot just in relation to dealing with everything on a day-to-day basis where you are experiencing high levels of stress, but you've got the base just to take a breath and think about how you're going to respond to a situation rather than react. So that I would, looking back, I would definitely really encourage that practice and finding a transcendental meditation teacher or Kriya Yoga or whatever works for you, but that twice a day, especially the second one, because that really just cleanses everything and sets you up for the rest of the evening and the rest of the day and sort of just gets rid of any sort of leftovers from the day that you've just had. So that would be one. The other one is exercising. I really enjoy that. I find it really gives me that sense of looking after my body, whether it be, you know, stretching and yoga or doing some form of strength and cardio training, walking on the beach, spending time in nature. Good friends and a nice bottle of wine definitely helps as well every now and again.
It definitely does sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you think about the phase you're in now, what does making work alongside parenthood look like today? Because in a lot of ways, of course, as your kids grow older, they need you less, but you're still their mum, you're still their parent. What does it look like now?
Yeah, so I interact with my girl pretty much daily, both of them. My youngest one actually lives across the road from me on the next property, so that's really lovely having her close by. And we get to spend a lot of time together. You know, we'll have a sauna together in the morning, or we'll go for a walk on the beach. And then my eldest, Kiana, lives in Queensland, but she's creative and social with the business. So we pretty much meet and speak every day. I think she probably gets a bit more of the raw end of the deal because our conversations are recent, being work related. But I do my best, you know, to have a non-work relationship with her as well and be there for as an emotional support. To me, I feel like, and both the girls have told me this too, is that we have a beautiful friendship. And so that gives me some sense of fulfillment, because even though at those times where I felt like I was failing as a mother, I wasn't present or I wasn't there for times that were pinnacle in their lives because I was prioritizing work over them, I feel like I have raised two amazing, beautiful young women who are very self-aware and who I have a beautiful friendship with. So that's more rewarding than having the business. So I feel like I didn't fail at being a mom. So that's, and kids are so resilient. They really are. I mean, I definitely had some challenges with both of them. I feel like, you know, those fundamental years of 0 through to 7, you really have to kind of nail that and just reassure them and be as present as you can be. And with that concept of them turning into decent human beings, I think it's such an important role. And then even if you do that, you might have some challenges again when the teenage years hit, particularly with girls, you know, the hormones. And I wasn't quite prepared for that with my youngest. And she terrified me from the age of 14 to 17. And I gave her an ultimatum. I remember I had the Life 360 app on my phone, and I was living in Melbourne then, and I'd be driving around the middle of the night trying to find her with this app, and I'd get her and I'd literally just drag her back into the car. And then it eventually got to a point where I was like, I cannot do this anymore. I said, you've got two choices. You can go to the army or you go to boarding school. Which one's it going to be? And then she did end up going to boarding school, and it was really difficult for her, but she did decide to go. And then that was the making of her, and I felt really grateful that I could give her that experience. But she needed that routine and that discipline that I was unable to give to her. So I think another big key takeout is setting boundaries, you know, healthy boundaries, and really, because that's what they're asking for. A lot of the time when that behavior plays out and they're being little shits, it's like, I need to set boundaries here and be strong and firm with those and not waver. Now, this is the boundary. No, you are eating this for dinner. This is what we're having. The end. There's not five choices of, do you want this? Do you want that? No, we're having spaghetti bolognese, or, and that's that.
Yeah.
End of story. But I think now being a parent too, it must be so much harder because we didn't have screen time. We didn't have phones and iPads and things like that to rely on. So I feel like it's also very important to give your child that nature connection time, you know, make sure that they get outside, make sure that they get fresh air, make sure that they eat food that's not processed, make sure that they have creative time, you know, to draw and create and use their brains in a way that's going to help them be expansive rather than be entertained. I can't even imagine, I mean, I'm sure looking back now that if I had to do it all again, I probably would have relied definitely on a phone or a laptop or a computer. Yeah, I don't even know what it'd be like to navigate that, but I guess you would have to just set those boundaries and be really firm with that. And I think that's one of the biggest key takeouts is, yeah, just stick to your guns 100% and make sure that you and your partner are like backing each other up on that, and not one not being the weaker link, that you're just like, no, we're doing this together.
Yeah.
And being on the same page. Yeah.
And you might not want to put words in their mouth, so totally up to you what you want to do with this question. But what do you think they recall Now, looking back at you, I'm sure as all kids, we have some frustrations if our parents are working at times. But now that they're a bit older, what do you think they reflect on now, looking back at how hard you worked really to give them a good life and to do the best you could?
Look, I definitely feel like at times they've felt a lot of resentment towards me and towards the business. But I do know now when they look at it holistically, they realize that that's given them opportunities and that it's also given them an advantage in life as far as, you know, I've been able to provide for them and support them. So I think they really acknowledge and appreciate that. And they'll both send me messages to say, I'm so proud of you, Mum. And I will get beautiful messages from both of them a few times a week. And yeah, they understand and appreciate. And they've seen how hard I've worked because they've been a part of that as well.
And recently you've launched your book. Firstly, tell us about the book itself. And secondly, I think, which will tie into that nicely anyway, is what we're sort of missing when we look at the beauty industry and what we should know.
Yes. So Truth in Beauty was first published in 2018. And I wanted to find, well, what I was looking for was ingredients that were questionable, that had been flagged as potentially being problematic, either from an environmental sense or also from a health perspective, endocrine disruptors, potential carcinogens, questionable impact on human health and environmental health. So what I did was I created what I called the A to Z blacklist. And the book is also, I sometimes refer to it as a shit sandwich. So it has some horrible, inconvenient truths, which is the A to Z blacklist. And then around that is some pretty nicer things to do with beauty and beautiful, you know, ingredients and how to work out what your skin type is and how to take care of your skin and what happens to your skin through the ages. And it's ended up being a 1.6 kilo, 400 page coffee table book that's got very robust referencing in there too. So whenever I've made a claim about something, that there's evidence there to support that and to back that up, because obviously, you know, we're living in a world where there's a very divisive audience as well that's going to have a different opinion about certain things. I think one of the biggest takeouts from the book too is really understanding how unregulated the industry is, particularly in Australia, and that other than a TGA approved good, which has to be more stringently regulated because you're making a cosmetic claim, that there is a not enough regulation. So in Australia, for example, anyone could literally create a skincare company. They could put whatever they wanted onto the label, but there's no one there actually checking it before it goes to market. So products may not have been correctly stability tested. They may not be correctly preserved. They may not be tested for shelf life.
That actually amazes me still in this day and age where we can uncover so much with social media and whatnot. That actually floors me, even that.
Yeah, so even recently there's been a couple of examples of that where there was another brand who was making all sorts of claims and selling their products and was all completely unsubstantiated. And even now sometimes I will go on and I'm always a big label reader and I like to look at the INCIs or the what's called the International Non-Commercial Ingredient List, which is what you look at when you look at the back of a label. It's the first place that I go to, in the same way that food, it's listed in the descending order. So I think for some people it's, you know, obviously difficult to decipher a label. So that was one of the other things I set out to do in the book. So like, what do you look for? How do you reverse engineer this so you know what is in the product that you're using or the approximate percentages of what is in the product? And then you can get a better understanding of how to use the product and also what's in it. So you want to look out for things like your Latin derivatives as well, botanical species. You look for where the preservative is. You look at what the preservative is. That usually sits around the halfway point. And then everything else below that is usually an extract or an active of some sort. So that's going to sit probably below 1%. So it's about deciphering what you're using and then also reducing your exposure to certain things that you may. I mean, I'm not saying I'm completely clean. I still get my hair done and I won't sacrifice that. I no longer get my nails done. So there's a big section on that. There's a big section on menstrual products as well, hair care, So it delves into a lot of different personal care products and their long-term impact and how there's not really enough epidemiological studies across a broad segment of people. But the ingredients that I have flagged in there, what happened halfway through the writing of this last book, the revised and expanded edition, I was about halfway through and I was thinking, should I bother with this? Is there any point in revising it? And there had been quite a few changes to the industry. And also in the States, there is now going to be more regulation like there is in the EU. And so when you export now to the EU, and this has been in place for some time, is that you have to have your products made in a GMP approved facility. So it has to be a good manufacturing approved facility, which means that your business is independently audited, which we have here. Also, having a certified organic status means that we're independently audited as well. So that happens a few times a year, and then they're very stringent. There's a lot of red tape involved with both of those audits. But what also inspired me to keep going with the rewriting of the book was I found an article back in 2023 that was from the New York Times, and it said, "What's in your personal care products? And here's what to do about it." Or some harmful chemicals that are found in your personal care product, and here's what to do about it. And there was over 700 comments with people that were concerned about these ingredients that had been flagged, and a lot of them, the A to Z blacklist, I think there was about 12 of them there. So then I realised that there was an engaged audience and a concerned audience that wanted to know more or have this information. So it's compiled, it's all at your fingertips and easy to digest compendium. You could sort of have it sitting there and flick through it and read the chapters, or you can read it from cover to cover. I think a lot of people are interested in the beauty industry now, and a lot of people, beauty aficionados, and want to know more. So I hope that they find it a helpful guide. I think a lot of people used to find that previous edition, they refer to it as their beauty Bible. So it's not your average beauty book. It's a whole lot more than that, and it delves into the deeper side, the darker side of the beauty industry as well. I mean, question, do we need all these products? Do we need more products? Do we need more stuff?
Yeah.
I think, and obviously the sustainability issue is a big one too, where we really have to be more conscious. Do we need more clothes? Do we need more skincare products? What do we actually need? And I really like this idea of being minimalist and not over-consuming.
Mm. Yeah. You're doing very well, because Posy has now entered this interview and you're still able to keep going. So thank you for that. I'll keep you for two more questions and then I'll let you go. Firstly, I guess, inspired by this book, what do you think is the quickest or easiest or first thing that you'd tell someone a little bit conscious, either of well-being or sustainability, either angle, to let go of or to focus on when it comes to their beauty? What's something quick that we, not quick, but what's something, I guess, intro level that we could all do?
Yeah. So I often talk about the three Ps, which is phthalates, fragrances, and preservatives. So being aware of what preservative is that is in products. I mean, all products have to be preserved for shelf life and stability and safety. So that's important. But there's certain preservatives that I wouldn't use. One would be parabens, another one would be phenoxyethanol, which is in just about everything. It is a broad spectrum preservative. It's cheap, but it is also a known irritant. It's used at an imposed limit of 1%. But if you're doing an audit, let's say you're using, on average, a woman uses anywhere between 12 to 15 products a day. So if you do a quick audit of that and then you look at how many products you use that contain phenoxyethanol, you're probably likely exceeding that imposed limit or that percentage limit. So we're not talking about this thing which is called MAF, not married at first sight, no, but the mixture assessment factor. So we're not taking into consideration multiple chemicals across multiple products and how they're interacting in unique and unquantifiable ways. None of that's been tested.
Yeah.
But I guess my biggest one, the biggest, simplest takeout would be, and I'm not going to be popular for this, but it's fragrance and perfume. A lot of people are suffering from fragrance allergies and sensitivities, and they're suffering in silence in enclosed, unventilated spaces. So there are allergens in a lot of those perfumes. There's also allergens, of course, that carries across to essential oils as well. So you need to use those with reverence and also with the respect that they can be quite sensitizing if used incorrectly or used in a way that you're using too many of them. And then fragrances are found in everything from our washing powders through our body lotions, through our shampoos, through our conditioners, to our hairstyling products. And so in a fragrance, there could be up to, 3,000 different constituents in there from a bank of, lots of different fragrances. And then you've also got a lot of other compounds in there. So you've got phthalates in there. You've got diethyl phthalate, which is what adheres to the skin, which is what gives you that staying power. So when someone puts a perfume on, it sticks to the clothing or the skin or where you place it. And a lot of the time we're putting perfumes on directly onto our lymph nodes. So that's it, straight into thyroid. And those molecular substances are quite small. So that's of concern. Plus you're inhaling them as well. And in some cases we're ingesting as well, not out of intentionally, but just through the process of our daily life. So if there was one thing, if you were sensitized or you were concerned, I'd really be starting to look at anything that contains a fragrance and looking at minimizing that or cutting it out.
Yeah, I think I'm going to look in my beauty bag too. That's a great tip. Check the ingredients in there.
Yeah, so there's a good little daily journal. There's a template in the book where you can print that out and go through there and do your own audit, but start, in the bathroom and look at everything and then look what you're using on a daily basis and then slowly look at minimizing or replacing those ones that do have questionable ingredients, which are also found in the book. So
yeah,
I've just made it a really simple process where you can use that as your guiding tool without having to go to all the effort of doing the research yourself. So I feel like it's just a really handy compendium to have, particularly if you are concerned about what you're using and the impact of that.
Yeah, it sounds like important work and a lot of work. Before I let you go, looking back over your journey of making work work as a mum, what do you think you're most proud of?
I'd say that I'm still here, that I'm still doing this, that I'm still in business and that I still love it. I do really enjoy having my own business and I'm really glad that I've stuck with it for this amount of time. We will be 25 next year, so it's a long time to be in business and to have been able to create a successful business and also to employ 30 people in a rural area is wonderful. And we still own all the formulations, they're still all mine, and we make them by hand in-house. So it's not lost its core roots. I'm still really proud of that fact too, that it's not a mass produced product. It's still got that magic about it that you don't get when you're buying something that's off a production line.
What an incredible journey. Thank you so much for sharing your story. If anyone wants to find your book or your range, your products online, where's the best place for them to go?
So Mukti Organics is the URL and also on Instagram and TikTok. And then my personal is by Mukti, BYMUKTI.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.